You're listening to episode 24 of FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we have a collaboration episode. I'm joined by Matt George of the Unsettled podcast, and we just have a really open dialogue. It's pretty long. We go down a lot of rabbit holes, but stay tuned. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in there. We talk about things like quotas, all the way to universal basic income, to homelessness, to just creating spaces for open dialogue. So I'm really excited about how this turned out, and I loved being able to chat with Matt really in depth, and I want to thank him for hosting me in his studio in St. John. So without further ado, here is our conversation.
Hey, Katie.
Hey, how you doing?
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So we are going to co-release this episode. You are also the host of a podcast.
Yeah.
Tell us about FemWonk. What is a wonk?
That's a great question. And actually, it's funny. So I'm sure perhaps when you were deciding what you would call your podcast or kind of the overall brand of some of the work you're doing, you probably thought a lot about what that meant, what it looked like. I, of course, did the same. In hindsight, FemWonk is not necessarily the most accessible kind of name or title. But basically, so wonk, a lot of the time you'll refer to somebody who's like really into the weeds on policy and things like that as a policy wonk.
A wonk.
Yeah. And so kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to bring that word in is it sometimes has a little bit of a negative connotation, right? Like, so this person's a bit of a wonk. But I love it, right? I love people who are in the weeds and they want to kind of talk about the nitty gritty of how policy is going to hit the road. So
that's kind of cool. I was listening to a podcast, Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History, the other day, and the theme of the show was you have to dig deeper. I mean, broad sweeping strokes, they just rarely work.
Yeah.
And it seems so true. I mean, broadly speaking, you could have a philosophy, a general philosophy that applies in a lot of areas, but you have to take each situation as its own.
Totally.
And go deep and be a wonk.
Yeah, no, I love that. And one of the things that I'm really interested in as well is as we, as a society, as we kind of get a little bit more complicated and complex, from a policy perspective, we're not going to be able to, and I think now we're not able to continue to develop what we've seen, which is just like one policy for everybody, right? The broad strokes, which just isn't a reality of how the world works anymore. So I think like when we start talk about digging deep, it's also, I think we have to go slow to go fast as well. And so I'm really interested in what that looks like as well from that perspective.
And that's,
I think, yeah,
that's probably a huge issue with some people because we do move so quickly. One of the things that I've repeated ad nauseum on this podcast, and it's probably getting boring at this point, but Twitter is not going to be the place we make sense to each other, right? It's not possible. It just doesn't, it doesn't afford you the bandwidth to really connect with someone. A platform like this, whether you and I come out of today disagreeing on certain policies, completely agreeing on other policies, at least we will have known that we made sense to each other.
Totally.
Right? At least we hashed it out.
Yeah.
But I mean, for God's sakes, on the platforms that we're using right now, it just doesn't afford you that time.
No.
And also some people don't want to take the time. So the social media war that's happening right now on places like Twitter and Facebook, it's a shame because it's just the death of sense making.
No,
instead of like public forums and things like that.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny you mentioned that. So now with our, with an iPhone, you have the productivity app or whatever it is that shows you how long you've been on your phone. And I'm on Twitter more than any other app on my phone. Yeah. And I was thinking about it recently and like it has, it used to be the place where I would get news and get updated on what folks are doing, connect with people, you know, that I don't know across the world. But now it just, it's almost depressing when you're on Twitter, right?
It kind of is. I kind of just post and get out. So it's a good way. I think it's a good way. Twitter's a good way to figure out what you think because you have to be concise about it.
Yeah.
But then on the flip side of that, if I steel man myself, I'm thinking, well, does being concise like that really get to the meat of an issue, or is this just a polarizing comment?
Totally.
When you don't mean it to be.
Yeah.
So getting intent is extremely difficult.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And I mean, I think you've even started to see, well, both sides of it, I guess. You'll see people who do the threads, right? And the threads will be really, really long now, or they just won't exist at all, when before you would see, you know, five or six tweets on the same topic. But yeah, I don't know. I'm
I haven't developed a full opinion on Twitter of today.
Mm, me too.
I like it. Again, I like it, but it's not necessarily always good for your mental health. Like, that's the reality, I think.
Yeah. So what's the origin story of the podcast? Why did you want to get on the mics and talk to influential people?
Yeah, so great question. It really came back to where I was at in my professional life. Mm-hmm. I was working in the Premier's office at the time, working on policies that I really loved because I thought they were impactful. I thought they could transform folks' lives. And we actually started doing some things that made New Brunswick first in the country rather than last in the country, particularly on some social issues. So the one I keep going back to because it's a little bit timely right now is in New Brunswick, we actually were the first province to publicly fund MFGAI MISO, which is the abortion pill. So we did that in 2017, and actually it was just recently that Manitoba and Saskatchewan became the last two provinces to fund. So we in New Brunswick have been offering this service for the last 2 years. And again, we were the first to do it. So, but when that happened, there was maybe one news story about it, maybe. And even now, you know, that dialogue doesn't come into the equation when we're talking about access across the country. But I was getting really frustrated with that because I was opening up the media, I guess I wasn't physically opening up the newspaper, but looking online. And I was reading stories about New Brunswick's debt and, you know, how we're a have-not province and how if we spend this money on this, we can't do this. And just all of this negativity in the news. And it was coming from both New Brunswick and elsewhere. And that just wasn't the New Brunswick I was living in.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, there were very obvious barriers that I was seeing every day as well. But we weren't able to talk about them, right? We weren't able to talk about, you know, the benefits of, say, universal childcare, for example, because we weren't allowed to talk about anything like that because our debt's so big or we have a deficit in our budget and just things like that. And that, to me, was not what I wanted to be thinking about and doing. I didn't want to wake up every morning with this defeatist attitude that we couldn't have these progressive, innovative conversations.
It seems like it's in a lot of issues in the province, it's always been more a narrative of cutting and not dying rather than adding. But it doesn't make much sense because if you looked at what we could cut, we could probably cut a certain percentage, but the amount you could add is infinite.
Right.
So why not talk about policy that moves us towards 21st century change and not just avoiding circling the drain like we imagine we have been as of late?
Yeah, and I think that's like such an important piece. We know, like, even, you know, people always make the comparison of like, well, you wouldn't run up your credit card, so why are you running up your provincial debt? But I think it also comes back to, if you reduce everything good in your personal life, then you're going to see personal impacts, right? Your mental health might suffer because you're not able to even maybe eat good food, or you're not able to go to a movie with friends or things like that. Like, so, I mean, yes, you have to live within your means. I'm not advocating you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like when we get to the brass tacks of things, if we cut everything that's good or everything that's forward thinking, even, you know, investing in your own education, things like that, a house, cars, that adds personal debt sometimes, most of the time. And without those things, your life, you wouldn't be able to kind of really, I don't know, like invest in yourself to create a positive future, I guess, maybe. And that's, I think, oversimplifying, but I think that we lack that conversation. But
so you were looking at public policy
and
you were a policy wonk.
Yes.
And the first word that you've attached to the podcast title is fem wonk.
Yeah. So exactly. So what I really cared deeply about was how do we have a more diverse conversation as well? How do we integrate gender equality into these dialogues? How do we integrate, you know, looking at just widely a diverse experience, right? We know that in New Brunswick, we have a large conversation around newcomers and immigration and why that's so important for our economy.
It's my world.
Yeah. So that's great. But if we just talk about that in the form of filling jobs, that doesn't enrich our province, right? That doesn't enrich the lives of folks that are perhaps literally uprooting their entire life to come here to this beautiful piece of the world that we love. So how can we talk about, you know, culturally diverse healthcare systems? How can we talk about the most diverse classrooms we've ever seen in New Brunswick and how to respond to that? And then again, just more broadly, like, what does a diverse experience look like when we're talking about public policy, when we're talking about current affairs, and things like that? Because unfortunately, that conversation really just, I didn't feel like it was happening in New Brunswick. And so I eventually was like, well, I can just sit here and complain and be upset about this, or I can use the expertise that I've been developing and just have this conversation. So that's what I decided to do.
Yeah, it's interesting that you chose policy, because I come from a very similar background as you. And I was considering as well, is it front lines work, or is it behind the scenes writing the policy? And the policy interested me on one hand, because in traditional societies, that those were the rules. The policy was the rules. But now, and I should call my podcast Tech Wonk or Culture Wonk, because the intersection of culture, business, and technology is what we're trying to amplify. And it's a very similar discussion, because let's take this example. You wanted to look at public policy written in government institutions. One thing we've looked at is policy in tech. So, for example, the people who are writing the rules on our global conversation is not the politicians.
No.
It's Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's Facebook.
Totally.
And the people who are writing those algorithms can also be extremely divisive. An example that is in the media right now is Twitter having very largely taken a side in regards to political stance. So in the beginning, they were a platform, similar to, like, let's say Bell, a common phone carrier. So if you and I are talking on Bell and I say something that is hurtful or hateful even, Bell can't be punished because it's a common carrier. It hasn't taken a side, but Twitter took sides. So now they're actually writing policy into the code of their platform. That strikes me as a whole different discussion we're about to have in regards to policy. And one of the places where we talk about culture and gender and inclusion the most is on social media.
Yeah.
So if we stepped back and looked broadly, where is ground zero in regards to the feminism movement right now? Is it tech and business, or is it politics? Is it healthcare? You mentioned healthcare. That's a big one. Where are you focusing a lot of your energy? And then we'll just go down all of these rabbit holes in regards to what's happening.
Yeah. So, well, I love that you brought up the tech piece, and I'll start my first rabbit hole here.
Perfect.
But you said, you know, the folks setting the rules are folks at Twitter, folks at Facebook, tech sector writ large, not necessarily the politicians. But my counterpoint to that is, I don't disagree with you, but those people still look very similar. Right?
Right.
We don't see diversity in either of those institutions. So you see, you know, these tech innovations happening that don't address diversity either. So my favorite example, or favorite is maybe not the right word to use, but the example I always go back to is when Siri was first developed, it could tell you all those weird, ridiculous jokes, right? That everyone would come up and be like, oh, ask Siri, like, what's zero divided by zero? Or like things like that, right? But it couldn't respond if you said, Siri, I just experienced a sexual assault. Don't know what that means. Try again. Right. And I mean, a better parallel was it could respond if you said, Siri, I just had a heart attack. So that tells me that in that development stage, there wasn't anyone around the table just bringing up the reality of, you know, Matt, like the reality of what sexual violence looked like.
So it wasn't a bandwidth or a capacity problem. There were actually analogous questions it could answer.
Right. Yeah. And that's it. So that to me says that there was a bias at the beginning. It has since changed. However, if we look at just it was in the media a couple of months ago now, facial recognition technology that couldn't recognize black faces. Well, I would be shocked if there were black faces in the room, right? Developing that tech. So that's what I'm also really interested in, is how do we. So I agree with you. Like these are at the these types of platforms are at the frontier of policy, and it will be public policy at some point, and it's starting to be.
Yeah, especially if it's regulated federally.
Right, and eventually it's going to be. There's no question about that. It's just how that happens. And I think actually that's probably why Twitter is starting to take a stance, right? They they want to set the rules. They don't want to be regulated. They want to set the rules and then let the regulation follow the rules that they've set.
It's interesting. So I'm guessing by the diversity in tech, you mostly meant phenotypic diversity, as in male, female, various different cultures represented, various different skin types. So people building the platforms are only building for a specific person, they're forgetting others. They're not being inclusive.
Yeah. And I think further to that, too, I think, you know, educational background as well, right? You know, we have such a big focus on getting women into STEM, which absolutely they need to be there. We know mm-hmm. that the numbers are abysmal there as well. But the reality is, too, there's not a lot of STEM programs that teach, and again, this is my own bias here, I'll recognize as a political science grad, but there aren't a lot of STEM type programs that I know of that mm-hmm. focus very heavily on, you know, the kind of world critical thinking skills, right? Mm. So that's another piece, right? How can folks in the arts, in political science, in the social sciences, how do we integrate those folks into our tech sector, yeah. right? And I think that's it, because it's not always, I don't think the algorithm necessarily always intends to have a bias, but at some point there are decisions that need to be made, and who are the ones that are making those decisions?
That's funny, because just before I came here, I wrote a piece about the best question that I got at our live interview last week at UNB mm-hmm. with the SHAD program. And a young man came up and he said, if we took self-driving cars, for example, when that self-driving car has to make a decision like hitting one person and not hitting another, where is the basis for that code coming from? Well, it comes from our cultural values. It comes from what the platform is told to do. And so I was thinking to myself, how can we possibly code for culture? And it depends so much, like you're saying, on who is writing the rules mm-hmm. and who those rules include. So my answer to him, it was more blunt than I intended for it to be, but he said, will we come up with a global culture code that we put into these systems? And I said, probably not. Mm-hmm. We're too different, and different is not a bad thing. I live in the world of different, and it's amazing. Mm-hmm. The food is different, the sounds are different, the sights are different, and it's a really beautiful thing to behold, especially with the biggest demographic change we've ever seen in Atlantic Canada. And so I said, no, I don't think we can. And then I got to thinking, if we could, what would it look like? And it makes me think that these little pockets of culture are going to pop up, where China will have to decide what its algorithms looks like, and North America will have to do the same, Europe will have to do the same. But who's at those tables probably makes a really big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question. And yeah, I think to your point too, as we see this diversity, and as we stop being such a kind of homogenous society, mm-hmm. we are allowing for folks that might have not had the opportunity before to experience different things writ mm-hmm. large, right? So I think of, you know, there are quite a few folks that live in New Brunswick that maybe have honestly never been outside of New Brunswick, maybe yep. been to PEI, Nova Scotia, right? Great. But they've never had the opportunity to, say, travel to India or, mm-hmm. or China or wherever. And so when they experience those small glimmers, they are defensive, right? Or they're automatically like, mm-hmm. this is different, or this is wrong.
It's scary.
Right? It's scary. So how do we, I think that's part of the question too. How do we create more equality across that spectrum as well, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you, and I think, again, how many minutes did it take before U.S.? no, that's what we've seen in the U.S., right? Like mm-hmm. folks are mobilizing around the narrative that Donald Trump brings because mm-hmm. of, I mean, you know, depending on who you ask, right? But there's a lot of this is different, this is scary, mm-hmm. I don't have this context. So I think that's a question too, is how do we
yeah.
build those experiences?
And the irony, well? You bring up Donald Trump, the irony of the rhetoric, especially as of late, directed at four female congresswomen, is so ironic in many ways, because I think he really has lived in a bubble his whole life, because there's a lot of good data, especially in the immigration sector, to suggest that America has actually done a really good integration job. And actually, there's data to suggest it's done better than Canada in terms of finding your Americanness and mm-hmm. your Canadianness. So yeah. you come and you maintain your own culture. That is your right. You have the right to pray the way you want, to access the clothing, the food, the sights, the sounds that you want. But you also adapt to things like the legal code. Yeah. And what it means to be American and to be Canadian. And we think of ourselves in Canada as extremely welcoming, and we are. But there's a lot of data to suggest that America has actually done a better job with a national identity. And then someone, I mean, it's the most diverse country on the planet, except for probably continental Europe. But then Donald Trump comes in and seems to forget that this is the country he lives in. Hmm. Or maybe what he's espousing is the country he wishes he lived in.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think he necessarily is forgetting. I think that he, well, I mean, his wife is an immigrant.
Like, there's irony everywhere. But it's just paradox after paradox.
Yeah, but I think it's so hard because what was the quote? I think it was actually the mayor of New York who said that, mm-hmm. or who I saw say this recently, which was that big corporations or billionaires mm-hmm. have taught us that our enemy is, like, immigration is our enemy, diversity is our enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole narrative of, oh, folks are stealing your jobs, which there's no evidence to suggest. Mm-hmm. Billionaires have created this narrative, so you forget that you actually should be mad at billionaires for taking all of the money. That's an oversimplification of it. But in my mind, that it like clicked to me because I think that is the reality in a sense. Like folks present nervousness or aggressive behavior because I think of insecurity. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, the 1% or the 0.001%. Continue to make more, and the 99% has not seen a real increase in, you know, whatever amount of years it is. I don't have the stats here in front of me. But that, I think that is the world Donald Trump is living in. He's mm-hmm. living in the world where he wants to protect the 1% that he is part of, and mm-hmm. that all of his friends and family are part of, and all the people that are lobbying him are part of, and all the people that he has created his closed feedback loop are a part of. And he is protecting that. Mm. He's protecting that America. And that is a problem in America, right? We know, well, the healthcare system is the most archaic in the developed world. Mm. Again, we've got all of these tech companies that are thriving in the U.S. and not paying any taxes. Mm. Like, so what does that mean, right? It means that you can't invest in education. You can't invest in a healthcare system. You can't invest in creating better conditions for, you know, folks in our most vulnerable situations. So I think he knows what he's doing, and that is the most scary part, I think, of the conversation.
Yeah, we have to have a very, especially in the immigration sector, we have to have a very strong public dialogue. There is evidence to suggest that in America and in Europe, far-right politics is directly analogous to high immigration levels. Mm-hmm. And that says some things that we have to be really honest about. It says that diversity and multiculturalism are difficult. Mm-hmm. They require a lot of effort from both sides.
Totally.
Diversity doesn't just get to automatically win the medal of being our strength. It's only our strength if we deploy it in a way that makes sense, that allows us all to build an identity together. So I'm trying to be very sympathetic to people, especially on the East Coast of Canada, that are nervous about the change mm-hmm. because it's new to them. Mm-hmm. So I feel responsible in some ways to have public dialogues like this to talk about where are we now, where do we have to go, and how do we go there in a way that doesn't equal blood in the streets?
Definitely, yeah, and I completely agree with you. We did two episodes on FemWonk around inclusive immigration, so we chatted with the New Brunswick Multicultural Council about the things particularly that they were doing to accelerate integration of women in the immigration sector, and then we chatted with an international student about why New Brunswick, why Canada, what were some of the challenges that he experienced coming here, why he wants to stay here, and kind of having that dialogue. And what I found so interesting, particularly chatting with KJ, was, you know, he's literally the biggest ambassador for St. John, particularly, and for New Brunswick. And he wants to stay here. He loves every second of it, and he wants everybody to come here. But he did identify, you know, the barriers that he's faced with integrating into the community. And so, that I totally agree. That again, is what FemWonk wants to do as well. Like, we want to be able to have these more diverse conversations that include voices that are traditionally left out of the public dialogue, whatever mm-hmm. that looks like, right? Whether mm-hmm. that is public policy or just, you know, media coverage or access to these kind of conversations on the streets.
So, mm-hmm. Here's one thing I've been thinking a lot about, and there were so many things that I wanted to ask you today, and we'll never get to all of them, but one of them is this. Can we legislate culture change?
Yes.
That's a big one. We can. I disagree.
So I think it depends on our respective definitions of culture change.
Ooh, that's fun.
Yeah. So and actually, let me circle back to, you know, the actual question you asked 15 minutes ago about modern feminism. So you referenced politics, you referenced kind of business, tech, and even kind of healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I believe wholeheartedly, and for those not in the room, I'm wearing my A Woman's Place is in the House
it's
t-shirt.
A great shirt. Yeah. It's I want one.
You can buy one at femwonk.com.
There you go.
And I fundamentally believe that we will not see real meaningful change in institutions, whatever they are, until we have a more equal representation. So, I mean, the story last week, Fortune 500 companies, record-breaking 6.6% female CEOs.
Record break.
Big deal. This is big, guys.
That's, we're almost at 7.
Celebrate, right? Yeah, so that is a problem. And we see that in politics as well. I don't know if you've been following the dialogue in Fredericton or in Fredericton City Council, but Councillor Kate Rogers mentioned 2 weeks ago now, I think she spoke publicly about it, the misogyny and sexism she feels as being the only woman council member in Fredericton.
Mm-hmm.
And this came because council put forward a recommendation to appoint 5 men to a committee, all men, and she basically called it out. But so that's, you know, local here municipally in Fredericton, and Fortune 500 companies, very different. But I think that's the reality. Until we get a better diversity in our decision-making tables, whatever they are, we're not going to see meaningful culture change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think further to that, you know, I think France is a great example of legislating quotas. But even California recently legislated quotas for corporate boards. And again, it'll blow your mind, but by 2019, they would legislate that every publicly traded corporate board would have to have one woman on it. So and these are the like things that are still happening, and people push back against quotas, but the reality or the research now again is continuing to suggest that they work. And I think that's we've got to look at what works, because we haven't had meaningful movement on women and broadly folks of diversity in decision making positions in, you know, 20 plus years. So
So what does in this regard, because this will be a fun conversation, what does working mean? Does working mean that eventually, so if you legislate something like a quota, then the quotas are enforced, and that in turn generates culture change over time? What does working mean in the research?
Yeah, so well, working in the simplest of terms is, yeah, hitting the quota.
Okay.
But the research suggests, particularly in the business sector, that once you've reached a 30% representation of one particular group, obviously the research still is based predominantly on women, there are more business benefits. Like the companies, and I could maybe send you the, I don't
totally,
have the stats
yeah.
here in front of me, but it's something like, you know, companies are more profitable, they see a better return on equity, things like that. But then you even just look at in Canada, one of the greatest examples is in Alberta. So when Rachel Notley was elected premier, she actually was the first, you know, the famous 50% gender balance cabinet is the Canadian government, but it was actually the government in Alberta that kind of did the first one. And because of that, they had to adapt their rules of the game, right? They had 3 members have babies in office, like, that's record breaking. One of them was their attorney general. So they had to actually develop maternity leave, which you would think that the institution making the laws and upholding the laws would at least have the basic, you know, coverages that we expect on our day to day.
Right.
So yes, there are research suggests that you see more diverse or like, yeah, I guess I'm trying to find a good way of quantifying that. But I think the easiest way of quantifying it is when people are different around the table, you see different challenges that are being faced, and then you have to address them.
Yeah, but, and just on its face, it seems like it would be a good decision. I mean, take your morality or whatever views you developed out of it. I was at a really good diversity talk by a man from, where was he from? Anyway. He was awesome, and he gave a great talk, and he surprised everybody in the room because he took New Brunswick, which is the province we're recording this podcast in right now, and he put the faces of all the elected officials on one screen, And he didn't say anything. But and then there was this little low like murmur and a little bit of laughter started. And he said, so if we were talking about your brand and you put out this photo to the world, this is your brand. And I think it was 95% white men, 5% white women. And I was trying to dissect the feelings that I was feeling because I try to steel man myself all the time. So if I have an argument, I try to think, what's the best argument against my point of view? Mm-hmm. And walk that road because that's a good way to know what you think. And I decided that what I felt was, it felt ugly. Mm-hmm. It felt ugly because the room doesn't look like that. I mean, the sector that I'm in, my friend group, I mean, it looks nothing like it. So I was thinking to myself, geez, do we run the risk of leaving people behind because we're writing policy and we're writing things into law that only reflect the makeup of that cabinet? It just looked ugly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even look like it makes sense.
Totally.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. No, I could not agree with you more. And actually, one of the things I found to be very fascinating, we did an episode a while back with Brian Glant, former Premier of New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. And he was, in his entire mandate, the minister responsible for women's equality. Obviously, that sometimes would get eyebrow raises. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I was like, tell me, why? Why was this the role you maintained? Why was this important to you? Walk me through it. And what I thought was the most fascinating part of why it made sense to him. And again, he did engage with like the women's equality groups in the province and they agreed that he should continue to keep the role. But when he was first elected leader, his entire caucus was male.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had to say, okay, well, an opposition caucus appoints critics. So the critics to ministerial roles. So there'd be a finance critic, a education critic, a health critic. Okay, well, we have a caucus of all men, so who's mm-hmm. going to be the critic for women's equality? And he said, basically, I'm going to take on that role as leader because we don't have that representation around our table, so the person in charge, I'm going to take that on, so it maintains that it is the most kind of, that there's a spotlight on it. A lot of people, I don't think, realize that that was kind of where the genesis, I guess, of him taking on that role the whole time. But that is such a huge problem when you have an opposition caucus mm-hmm. or a government caucus, whatever it looks like, that doesn't have any representation, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, you'll see regional representation. I do think that's important. But yeah, so I think when you say folks get left behind, yeah, 100%, because they're, through no fault of your own, you represent your own lived experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can, of course, identify your own biases and do things to
ameliorate steel man them. Yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. You can absolutely do that. And people should be doing that all the time. I do it all the time. And I will recognize anytime I think I'm coming into something with a bias, I will state this is my bias.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying in a lot of times is this is my lived experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. But again, I'm not going to surround myself with people that all have exactly the same biases as me and exactly the same lived experience as me, because what the heck are we going to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I think that's the reality. Like, if you don't have people around the table, then you're going to just have the same conversations over and over again.
Yeah. Let's keep going down the road if we can of quotas, because there's two more things that I think are a really interesting discussion in 2019. What things specifically do we legislate quotas for? There was an interesting, I was trying to think about, okay, what does this mean to me? There was an interesting stat that went through the top five most dangerous jobs in America, and they're all done by men. It's things like tree cutting and hard physical labor and stuff like that. And there are not women that are banging down the door to get into these fields. They're messy jobs, they're hard, they're hard. I don't know if anybody wants to work coal anymore, right? I mean, it's just not a 21st century industry. But things like STEM and high-paying tech jobs, we still have disparity as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we legislate quota-wise? Do we legislate quota-wise for people who are trying to break into these industries but are being barred from doing so?
Yeah, so, well, I would just challenge your definition of most dangerous jobs, right?
Sure.
So that is the ones you would mention, and I
physical danger, yeah.
Physical danger, right? So I would love to know the jobs that are that have the highest suicide rates, for example.
That's interesting.
And actually, I do think I can't remember. I have to do a little Google on this, but I think like pilots are one of the highest mm-hmm. rates of suicide.
Are dentists?
Yeah. It's like very interesting. Like, but those jobs, some of them are male dominated. But so that I'd first challenge definition of dangerous.
Yeah, that's interesting.
On the other side of that is we also know like some of our most precarious jobs, home support workers, for example, nursing home workers who are kind of working in burnt out situations as mm-hmm. well. And we don't have men knocking on the door to come to those professions yep. either.
My mom's a nurse and she is very burned out.
Yeah, totally. And you probably ask any nurse in the province and they would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, there is, as we know as well, a correlation to lower paying jobs that are done by predominantly women as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a question of value. So I think that's interesting. Like where do you legislate quotas? These are, in many cases, complex problems, right?
Oh, yeah. So, that's why they're so interesting. I mean, yeah. you made two great points there in terms of value and in terms of definitions of what actually constitutes a job that someone doesn't want to do or is dangerous. Maybe a good place to start is politics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why would we not
yeah.
legislate cabinet quotas at the very least? And people always bring up this meritocracy argument, and some of it gets me. But most of it doesn't, because we want to have a diverse set of opinions in the cabinets that are writing the rules mm-hmm. in our public life.
Yeah.
That seems like ground zero.
Yeah. So that the question again is, as you challenge, what does meritocracy mean, right? Mm. Does it mean that we want politicians that have, you know, PhDs? Maybe. There are not a lot of them. But there are a lot of, you know, business folks or lawyers, for example, not a lot of nurses, not mm-hmm. a lot of, so, but again, why, my question is, you know, the Canadian Constitution is written in a way that says, here are your qualifications to run for office. You got to be 18, you got to be a Canadian citizen.
Cool. Pretty open field.
Cool. Yeah, exactly. So what, I think it's challenging folks on what their definition of merit is, right? I think I want a politician. I've thought a lot about this over the last, I would say, year and a half. And I think for me, the most important thing I want in a representative is authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Comes down to that. And I think you could be a lawyer and be authentic, totally. But you could be a nurse or a school teacher or a community organizer or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Or a recent grad, like maybe, I don't know. So I think it's challenging what merit means. But I also think even further from that is like, well, actually, and New Brunswick is a good example of this as well. One of the things that was committed on in the last, in 2014 was that all public appointments to agencies, boards, and commissions would be 50% men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, that was really hard. But as people changed their mindsets, it got easy and it was done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so that is what happened. So I think it's, if meritocracy is the argument, and from a political party perspective, because that is how members get elected, it's up to the membership to decide what merit looks like, but mm-hmm. I think it's also up to the parties and Elections Canada, for example, or Elections New Brunswick, to identify what barriers they've built into their policies that make it harder for folks of diverse background to even get to
mm-hmm.
the membership, to even get to presenting themselves to the membership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a good, that's a great thought. That's a great thought.
What was the initial question?
There's also, I was dealing with this kind of Orwellian idea of quotas the other day that freaked me out. I don't know if it holds water at all. I haven't thought it through enough. Maybe someday I'll think it through and put some ideas on paper. But the thought was, okay, if we legislate quotas based on phenotype
mm-hmm.
Above the quality of ideas, and again, we'd have to parse what quality means,
mm-hmm.
Will we eventually accidentally fall down a slippery slope where written into law, certain people based on their phenotype, so for example, I am a white man. I can only have these jobs, mm-hmm. these opinions, live in these places because of lived experience. So I think the creator of the idea was thinking in the George Orwell 1984 kind of philosophy that if we go down the road of legislating quotas as opposed to forming cultural agreements around equality and diversity, that we fall down this slippery slope of eventually everything becomes legislated and certain people can only do, say, and think specific things. Mm-hmm. I thought, when I read it, I thought, that's really interesting to parse that out because we should go down these rabbit holes.
Yeah.
But does it hold weight? Does it hold water? I haven't thought it through.
Well, I would say that we already do that, right? Like, we have unintentionally already created systems that don't are not open to certain subsets of the population, right?
Interesting.
You mentioned STEM. Like, why are the enrollment numbers actually going down instead of up, right? Why do we have, like, so that is, I think we have created that system already, and I think we've done it because the people that have created the system created systems that worked for people like them, mm-hmm. and the people around the table did not necessarily bring a diverse perspective. So I think we've already done it. And so my question is, how do we create a balance? But I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think I have heard as well the argument around if we go down the rabbit hole of only people with lived experience or of that lived experience can represent others with that lived experience, mm-hmm. then like that's not what our political system is set up to do, right? It mm-hmm. is set up with you represent a person to represent the values of your constituent, whatever that looks like. Mm-hmm. So if we get politicians that just say, hello, I'm from this area and I cannot represent anybody
right.
that does not look, feel, and think right. like me.
I can answer no questions about anything yeah. other than, yeah.
right. But what does that look like, right? And I think, again, it's if you have politicians that are authentic and are willing to listen and are willing to get uncomfortable and are willing to have their ideas challenged mm. and are willing to speak for themselves, then I think we can get to a place that is more inclusive. Yeah, but I think, again, on the quota side, I don't necessarily think it's quotas forever, right? Mm. It's let's get to this number or
get the ball rolling.
Yeah, because yeah. again, in like in New Brunswick, a perfect example in the last provincial election, we elected a record number of women, 11 of 49. Like, at this rate, we're never going to have just equality of gender binary,
right.
right? Let alone further, right? We have no people of color elected to the mm-hmm. legislature in New Brunswick, no Indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's hard to define, you know, educational levels, et cetera, but we have almost no diversity right now. So mm-hmm. how do we implement that? And I don't know, right? It's messy. Like, I think yeah. that is, and I think that's kind of what you're saying as well. Is like,
but it's so valuable to have yeah. this discussion.
Totally. And again, I think we do need to create more, we have to have more dialogues like this so that we can figure out what we do value as more of a collective. Mm-hmm. I think it's Barack Obama that has continued to say before social media or even in the beginning of social media, we had shared values, or mm-hmm. at least we thought we had shared values.
Mm-hmm.
We now don't have shared values. And so when we don't have shared values, how can we be governed, or what does that look like? What is that model?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so bang on. Like, I mean, I would not shock listeners to know I'm a little bit more left-leaning.
you?
Yes, it's true.
Left of center.
Breaking news. but like, because of that, my social media, like it, the algorithm or whatever, it influences, it shows me stuff I want to read and then I'm learning about things I care to learn about. Yeah.
You'd have to intentionally steel man yourself.
Right. And I've started trying. I follow like, you know, policy folks I don't disagree with necessarily, and it's so interesting to see their perspectives. But if I have a conversation with somebody that is more aligned with the growing populism we're seeing again in the US and in Canada, we're not having the same conversation.
Uh-huh.
We don't have a shared understanding of of the news even, right? Mm-hmm. We don't just have, you know, turn on the dial to CBC and everybody's listening to it. We don't have that anymore. So I've had that occur. I've had people be like, hello, Katie, why is this happening? And I'm like, what? Where did you find that information? Like, mm-hmm. And sometimes it is a bit more fake newsy, but mm-hmm. but a lot of the time the kind of false news, alternative facts, whatever it's called on a day to day, a lot of the times it's based in some sort of reality, right? Mm-hmm. The truth is twisted, but it is based in some sort of reality. So yeah, I think that is a really big conversation. How do we find out what our community values are?
Yeah. One thing that concerns me with the public discussion is there's the social justice movement right now, which I hope I'm a part of. I haven't signed any formal membership, but
where's your card?
I think I like to speak and fight on behalf of these issues, but I worry sometimes about scale because, for example, there are things that I can't change and there's things that you can't change. Mm-hmm. Luck of where you were born, what family yeah. situation you were born into, your skin color. You can't change those things. So there's no scale there. So let's try to find where there is scale, where there's scale in the quality of your ideas and your mind can change. Mm-hmm. And your mind can change pretty drastically. There's this famous man I'm reading about right now, and he's famous in the social justice movement for converting former members of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm. And he has converted, let's say, 15 or 16 people who have left and have radically changed their views on race mm-hmm. because this man took the time to sit down and try to understand them.
Yeah.
Because it all makes sense somewhere. Mm-hmm. Let's unpeel it. Is it fear? Is it something that happened to you? Is it where you were born? Is it the ideas of your parents? That can scale. Those things can change. So it's worrying that someone like Donald Trump, for what an ugly person he seems to be, if he makes a good economic decision, it's so hard for us to applaud him because of the person he is. Mm. But we almost have to if we want to maintain some sense of, okay, can our minds change or can they not? So the global discussion kind of freaks me out sometimes because we let go of that idea of scale and one person, it say they're on the right and you and I are on the left. It's very hard for us to see the bridge that connects us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it is easier on some issues than others, right? Mm-hmm. And that I think for me is where, where the real differential is on, you know, I think on, in a lot of cases, like you kind of mentioned economic issues, it's a little bit easier to see other sides of the argument on economic issues than it is on social issues, particularly when the counter argument is about repealing rights for certain people and groups, yes. right? So that, I think it depends on what type of issue it is and how you can kind of see each other's sides. But I totally agree with you. I think there's no value in us sitting here screaming at somebody or not even willing to have a conversation about understanding where they're coming from and recognizing that in a lot of cases, there's more that unites us than divides us, right? So how do we, and that I think again comes back to how do we have those common dialogues, right? What are the things that do unite us? And let's start from there and then figure out, you know, how we can move forward on some other things. But again, I always say that and then I recognize my privilege and I recognize that for some people that's not, they can't do that, right? Their rights are under attack right now in the US, for example. So you can't even have a dialogue of understanding when somebody that you're talking to fundamentally doesn't think that you should be equal to them, right? So. And that's tough. I don't know. I have no idea how you get over that. No idea.
Yeah, neither do I. We're not going to figure that out today. So we're co-releasing this podcast.
Yeah.
So we need to give you the floor too. What are some things you're thinking about right now?
Yeah. Well, I actually would just love to know kind of your origin story. Like why are you having these conversations with folks and some really amazing people? That's what really drew me into your podcast. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, yes, I want to hear more about what, you know, James Mullinger is thinking about, what David Alston is thinking about, Robin Tingley is thinking about, all these amazing folks that I'm really drawn to. So yeah, tell me more about what made you decide to go down this road.
Yeah. So I mean, where to start? So if you looked at the 2019 laundry list of what would be considered North American privilege, I'd probably tick next to them all. Mm-hmm. there are a few things, obviously. People's lived experience is completely different. I mean, when you talk about your parents, and for example, I had a powerful career mom and a stay-at-home dad. Mm. So immediately my experience of what would some people would call a traditional North American home was flipped. Mm-hmm. And so my ideas about what it meant to take care of a family and raise a family of four kids and two parents was different right out of the gate. But there were a lot of those boxes I ticked. And when you come from a place like I come from, you don't really see how the world works. Mm-hmm. Because the situation we've come to with our social agreements and our culture agreements and our systems, nothing ever went wrong. There was always food.
Yeah.
The police always came. The schools were always open. And so I recognized pretty quickly when I grew up that I needed to see what the world was really about. And so starting at 18, from about 18 to 25, I was all over the world working in different experiences and understanding how do we make sense to each other. Mm. That's what every single experience, whether it was being face to face with a really messy election in Malawi in the Great Lakes region of Africa, or being between the borders of Ecuador and Colombia, understanding what the Colombian diaspora is experiencing in Ecuador. The city I was in Ecuador had 60,000 Colombians from the FARC violence in the 90s. And so I was trying to understand, how do we make sense to each other? Because back home, for whatever reason, the systems never break. Then I go and live in countries where the social institutions have all broken down. And understanding what does that look like, and how do you navigate it? And what do I want from my life? Mm. Do I want to participate, or do I want to just idly follow the path that was set for me from where I come from, which is 12 years public education, a 4-year degree, and then go work for JDI?
Yeah.
And I decided that I wanted to have public conversations around how we make sense to each other. And what I found that really compelled me to having these conversations was the intersection of culture, business, and technology. We have such, and that's intentionally broad, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I could not pigeonhole myself. If somebody asked me what I do, I have no idea what to tell them. I just tell them I'm an entrepreneur, or I work in immigration, or I say a bunch of different things. But it's intentionally broad because it's such a fascinating public discussion. And we live in a region that will be going through growing pains.
Is going through
growing pains. We don't have high diversity. And we're just now undertaking, since 2015, the early Syrian response, which I had the pleasure of working on in the city. We're going on this diversity experiment, and we're figuring out how to make it work. We don't have 21st century industries, but we could layer on 21st century technology onto those traditional industries. But I thought, we're going through growing pains. Navigating 21st century change is hard. Let's get some of the smartest people working in these fields, like you said, whether it's Robin Tingley or whether it's David Alston. David Campbell the other day was fascinating as well. And look at, how do we navigate these changes? Mm-hmm. Because it's not easy. And in some ways, as pithy as it is or not, we need each other.
Yeah.
And we need each other in a way to say, look, let's have these discussions publicly. Because if we navigate them publicly, then we have a chance at laying a blueprint. Mm-hmm. If we don't, we don't.
Totally.
So that's that.
Yeah.
And hopefully that origin story isn't too long.
No, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of follow-up questions I have, a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that that's so interesting. And one of the things, again, I think you said about, you know, Atlantic Canada, we're experiencing these growing pains. And the reality kind of is that we're going to experience it. We are, and we're going to experience it. Experience them. There we go. First. But they're going to kind of cascade across the country, really. And in a lot of the developed world and Western world. My question keeps coming back to, like, how do we use that to our advantage? How do we become a model? How do we find out what works so that others can adopt that, and others can kind of figure out how to scale that to what works for them? But again, there's, what does that look like, right? How many different challenges and issues are there? And I actually would love, I haven't, it's on my drive list to listen to your podcast with David Campbell. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in what a guaranteed basic income looks like. Mm. I'm interested in how that could be the solution. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that the silver bullet? And I haven't listened again. I have no idea. I'm going to be saying exactly the opposite of what David said, but I'm so interested in that. And the reason is, like, you talk about systems. Mm-hmm. there are a lot of systems that aren't working in New Brunswick, you know, whether it's the, you know, social safety net and what that looks like, right? And whether it's at the end of, you know, social assistance, which has not gone up in years and years and years and is not a livable income for anybody,
mm-hmm.
Or whether it's, you know, our retirement funds, right? Like you and I, are we going to be paying into this great government pension for the next 40 years of our lives?
Right.
Probably not. How are we going to retire? So it's like all of these social safety nets. When I think about the future of work or the future of our communities, mm-hmm. What are they going to look like? And could we develop one solution?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm really interested in guaranteed-based income. And I really think that regions like the Atlantic Canada could do it on a small scale, figure out how, and then it could be scaled, mm-hmm. right? I'm really interested in that.
Okay, that one's cool. So there's three things.
And that's culture, tech, and that's all of the things.
There's three things at a minimum that I want to say about that, and hopefully I don't forget any. But UBI, right. there are a whole, it's one of these weird things that looks to be split down the middle, because there's people, it goes back to legislation or cultural agreements. Mm-hmm. And that one is legislation. So what you're talking about in nuts and bolts is people being able to vote themselves money. Mm-hmm. So for example, Andrew Yang and the Democratic yeah. Party right now, the freedom dividend, he calls it. It's $1,000 a month guaranteed for every citizen over the age of 18. And you can opt out, but you automatically get it. So that's a neat thing mm-hmm. onto itself. There's people who think that's a slippery slope, because if you're going to vote yourself $1,000 a month, it would become a political platform to vote yourself $1,500 in the next election. So people will use it as a running tool when they go to run for government, regardless of the economic effects and how much it costs and effects on entrepreneurship and stuff like that. But on the base social level, we have to be able to ensure that everyone eats and everyone has shelter.
Mm-hmm. We're not doing a good job at that.
And just on its face, the idea that there are people who are homeless, if you just step back, and this sounds woo-woo, but I don't care. If you just step back, I mean, that's a ridiculous thing. It's a ridiculous situation.
Well, and even just here in St. John, the Human Development Council, when they released their last report, I think they quantify it as there are 100 people in St. John that are homeless. 100 people like that. What? We could fix that tomorrow.
Yeah, 100 like, people would fit in this small building.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so UBI is a cool one because mm-hmm. it does go back to either legislation in the short term to get the ball rolling and not relying on social cultural agreements, or you flip the script and say, look, everybody's got to eat, everybody needs shelter, and then let's figure it out.
Mm.
So that one's pretty cool.
Well, and that's what Elizabeth Warren is saying, right? In the U.S., she's saying, well, look, let's get, you know, let's tackle anti-corruption, let's, you know, tackle all these things and then see if that's working and then we can come back to this. But I actually think it's the exact opposite. I think it's let's do this and see if it fixes some mm-hmm. of the other
challenges, is a devil's advocate that has come up in my world recently. So in the 2015 Syrian response, there are many, many families in St. John that have been on social assistance ever since.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that it doesn't solve for meaning, and mm-hmm. it doesn't solve for self-worth. I'll give you one example. Some of the countries that we served in that effort have what would have previously, probably in our grandparents' time, been called a traditional gender makeup in the home.
Mm-hmm.
So mom typically stays at home and raises the kids, and dad typically goes out and earns the bread. We've seen a lot of depression within families because the dynamic has been broken, because one of the two is not fulfilling their own personal moral obligations to the family. Not being able to access work and not being able to access impact in the community for a whole host of reasons. I mean, immigration is very difficult, especially for those coming from a refugee background. Cutting a check doesn't solve for that. So that's one thing we'd need to figure out. What we'd probably have to do, we'd probably have to layer on social programs, like free retraining programs for those who are not working in 21st century fields, or community centers or clubs or mm-hmm. something to solve for the community and meaning piece. Because when you take away impact but cut a check, there still is a lot of human things that are unsolved.
Yeah. So I think in the refugee situation, it is particularly unique. Mm-hmm. Because again, there are language barriers, right? It's very difficult to contribute to your community.
Absolutely.
If you can't speak the language. And actually in Fredericton a few years back, I volunteered as like an English second language tutor. And it was so fascinating because that, again, you're kind of what we call stereotypical gender roles. Father worked, mother stayed at home. I think they had four kids with the other on the way.
Mm-hmm.
There was no ability for the mother to be able to learn or practice English. Yep. And so that automatically isolates her,
yep.
right? No, and no question, and there's just no access for her to be able to access community at all. So that is a unique challenge within itself. But there is also no research to suggest in the areas that they have piloted a universal basic income
mm-hmm.
that purpose leaves. So in Finland is a great example, and it's kind of the funny, based on the way that we think, it's like that false stat, but it's there was no change in unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're taught to think like, oh, that's terrible. But that's actually a good thing in a universal basic income pilot because that means that people didn't exit the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
But I think... So I think that's interesting. I do think it supports certain types of industry and folks. So what we, and in Manitoba, I mean, it was, you know, decades ago now in Canada, but what they did see was that more moms were able to stay home longer with their kids when they were born,
mm-hmm.
And people were able to stay in school longer. Mm-hmm. So those are two, I would say, positive probably
yep.
things. And then in Ontario, I think that they didn't have a long enough pilot, but they did see a little bit of an uptick in entrepreneurship. So I think it again goes back to what we've chatted about, like what are the goals and what are the values, right? Is our value to ensure that everybody has their basic human needs met?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, no. Is our goal to ensure everybody has a job? Yes, no, and what does that mean, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's also, you know, folks that advocate for the guaranteed job.
Mm-hmm.
But I think these are the questions we have to have, right? But I think
totally.
There are a lot of cop-outs, right? There's a lot of, I think the, everyone just wants to work is a cop-out.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a cop-out or is it it's just an invitation to have a more broad discussion?
Yeah,
or
fair
a cop-out
enough.
Maybe for someone who's spewing it for political purposes?
Yeah,
or for...
I think it depends, right? I think we are wired to automatically think that because that is the society that we have lived in and grown up in. And I do
mm-hmm.
believe, I agree that everybody wants to contribute. But what does that look like? Right?
Yeah, that's a great question. Is reinventing work is
mm-hmm.
probably one of my top five interests
mm-hmm.
right now because... You're right. What is contributing?
Mm-hmm.
Sebastian Junger, who is a war correspondent you may or may not have read, wrote a great book called Tribe. And there's some kind of deep, whether you believe in evolutionary theory or not, it doesn't matter. There is some inbuilt need to feel needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and you've all know Harari talks about this too, with this in the 21st century, the growth of this useless class, he
mm-hmm.
calls. So if the economy doesn't need certain people and you can get by without your community members, you have a really weird situation because now you're not dependent on each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really skeptical of hyper-independent people.
Yeah.
I think you really need people.
Yeah, totally.
And you need to feel like you're having an impact.
Yeah, I completely agree.
But that doesn't have to be working a meaningless job. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
What's a job?
Totally. Well, and actually, I just read a study the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives put out. The average one-bedroom renting price and two-bedroom renting price in all of the CMAs, the Canadian metropolitan areas in Canada, and how many hours you would have to work if you were working on minimum wage in that city per week to afford to live. And actually here in St. John, it would equal 44 hours a week to rent a one-bedroom apartment.
Mm-hmm.
In Moncton, it's 48, and those are among two of the lowest in the country. You know, when you get Toronto, Vancouver, it's closer
right.
to like, you'd have to work 100 hours a week on minimum wage
right.
to afford a one-bedroom apartment. So, yeah, so again, and unfortunately, in some of those cases, those jobs are not entirely meaningful to the folks working them. So that's the question I have is how do we say, yes, people want to find meaning?
Mm-hmm.
Society also has to work, right? Like
yep.
that, there's no question we have to build that into. But what does that look like? And those are the conversations that, you know, folks need to have.
Totally. And that's the ones that we're having. And they even go, they have so many interesting throughways. For example, if we're only measuring meaning in terms like GDP,
yes, exactly.
We completely miss the boat, because that assumes, as you know very well, that you have to be producing economic activity to be even factored into the stats.
Right.
So one of the things that Andrew Yang has said as well that I think is really interesting is, why the hell is raising children not a job?
Yes, exactly.
Because the economic activity you're generating is technically zero. Dent to GDP is technically zero. We'll change the damn metric then.
Exactly. No, that. So in, I think, two episodes ago, we did like an Ask Us Anything episode. And one of the questions was like, what in 25 years, what will be the conversation we're having? And I hope it's not that long. But I want to have the conversation of, how do we flip our economy on its head to measure actual work and not dollar output, but work? And it's not just, you know, childcare, but it's also, you know, senior care again,
in
New Brunswick. Yeah. But we know like we have a huge aging population, and right now that's creating backlogs in our hospital and our nursing home systems. Why couldn't there be a value placed on, you know, a kid of the elder person, taking care of them, and not gaining an income, right? What is the value put on that? So yeah, I think that is the question. Like, we need to reimagine the entire economy in a way that values all work. Yeah.
And it has so many throughways. So let's think about an example that goes right back to feminism. I've heard people make the claim, and I mean, how much can you hear people online, but you're reading their thoughts. Yes. People claim that, so for example, because raising children and being in, as you called, a stereotypical situation in the home, so staying home and raising the family while your spouse goes out and makes the money, is not factored into GDP, is not considered productivity, when, I mean, it's the most important job you could possibly have as a parent. And like I said, my roles at home were flipped. Dad was at home. Mom was out earning for us. And so it was so interesting to see how value is placed on each one. And there's so much more value placed on the one who's seen as being productive, in air quotes, big time air quotes.
Yes.
But let's do a throughway into feminism. This is an interesting conversation. I've seen the argument that says, if I'm mom and I go home and I want to raise my family instead of, for example, be a tech CEO or go work as an engineer, I'm scared I won't be celebrated by the modern feminist movement, because it's seen as not living up to whatever my full potential might be or full equality. That's interesting. But also, again, you have to really think that through to know if that holds any water at all. I mean, are we celebrating childcare? We probably should be. There's a lot of evidence to suggest we're not valuing it economically, but certainly we should be.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think the modern feminist movement definitely has its challenges. As every movement does. One of them is, in my view, how do I frame this? We don't put enough weight on the reality of the definition of feminism, which is equality, point blank, right? And I think equality also means being empowered to make your own decisions, whatever they are. And if your decision is man or woman to stay at home and raise your children there, and that's great, good for you, congratulations, but you've been empowered to be able to make that decision, right? I think that is the differential. Being empowered to make that decision is the, I think, the bread and butter to that argument, because we know that there are still lots of folks that aren't empowered to make that decision, even if that's the decision they would make. And then I think going back to valuing childcare, again, if we take the argument of economics, no, we don't value childcare. You know, childcare workers are some of the lowest paid in our economy. And, you know, I find it very odd that you could be a childcare provider for a 4-year-old, and then the second that 4-year-old turns 5 and goes to school and has a teacher, that person now is making significantly more, is maybe not the exact differential, but they're now making a whole lot more money than the person providing care for a 4-year-old. So that, I think, is a very interesting question. What does why is that the case? Is it because the teacher has a 4 or 5 year degree and the early childhood educator maybe has a 2 year certificate, or whatever that looks like? Is that the differential? Maybe. But I think a bigger part is that for 0 to 5 year old care, we ask parents to pay it, and for, you know, 5 to 18 year old care, the government pays it, right? Mm-hmm. That's the reality. So I think that's a conversation we've got to continue having too. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we talk about, you know, ending cycles of poverty, I don't think it's fair that families that have the means to pay for high quality childcare are the only ones that get to access it. Because again, once we're 5 and we're all in the public system, kids are starting off on an uneven playing field, right from the get-go. So yeah, but that's a whole other rabbit hole.
One of the fascinating things as we walk through this demographic change in the area is there are a lot of situations where we need to find common ground, mutual respect, but our values don't align.
Yep.
So for example, there are a lot of communities in this area that, for example, the discussion around LGBTQ rights is not part of their value system.
Yep.
So we have on one hand, gender inequality, and then on the second hand, we have diversity and multiculturalism. That's why that discussion is so difficult, because we have to agree on a base number of things, equality probably being like the penultimate. But then we also have to respect individual values and lived experience. Walking that road is not always easy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think a lot about this because I think, and back to a point you mentioned earlier, like recognizing your own privilege, I think about it a lot because I think about all the time, like, am I taking up space that somebody else could or should be taking up? Am I, you know, how am I presenting to the world based on my lived experience? How can I use the privilege that I have and recognize that I have to allow for others to engage in dialogue? And am I doing enough of that? Am I doing that in a meaningful way? So, like, I think about this all the time. But the flip side of that is I just don't. Values to me are different from not respecting people's fundamental rights. And that's what it comes down to for me. And again, in Canada, we have one of the most progressive, you know, Charter of Rights and Freedoms. We respect people's rights based on gender, sexual orientation, diversity, ethnic background, religion. At least our laws of the land say we do. So I think that for me, values is one thing, not respecting people's rights is another. And in New Brunswick, we take it a step further with language. Like, this is a conversation we have around bilingualism still. So I think that goes back to having open dialogues about why we need to respect people's rights and remembering that in some cases, like in New Brunswick, there are some people that probably have never met, you know, a trans person, for example.
Oh, certainly.
And so that is different and scary for them. But just because it's different and scary doesn't mean that we should not allow folks that are trans to have rights.
Right.
For example.
Right. So there's individual value systems based on your lived experience, but then there's a public stage where we all have to come to some kind of agreement that equality is the law of the land. And sometimes you have to go along to get along. So it might be scary, but this is where we're going to go.
Yeah.
And this is what we're going to say. Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are individual value systems, but when your values encroach on the rights of someone else, then we're in troubled territory.
Yeah, and I think it is up to folks like you and I to, again, be open to having that dialogue with somebody who's might not had the opportunity to start their journey, right? Like, that's the reality. It's meeting people where they are and saying, it's okay that based on your lived experience and you know, perhaps lack of other opportunities, you have these feelings. Let's talk about it and let's figure out how, you know, how we can just have that dialogue and how we can perhaps shed some light on each other's perspectives and recognize what that looks like and then move forward together, right? It's, But I think that is so fundamental, is being open to having those dialogues and not just shutting people down because they don't have the same opinions as you do. Because again, I think that goes back to privilege, right? It goes back to our privilege for being able to have, you know, experiences like traveling around the world, experiences like having, you know, more diverse friend group, having access to education, things like that. So I think really for me, that's what's fundamental, is being able to engage with somebody openly, open-mindedly, really, and recognizing that we're all on our own kind of journeys. I like to call it the feminist journey. I think everyone should be on a feminist journey, but some people might not be there yet, and that's okay. But let's get them there, and like let's meet people where they are on their own journey.
Do you think the people who want to have public dialogue like you and I, do you think we're the majority? And that's just that the loudest voices on social media are amplified because of the algorithms? I'll give you an example. There's a controversial political party. It's hard to even call them a political party in Canada because they have so few people that are advocating on behalf of them. We won't even name them because that's what's there's no point. They can be in silence as far as I'm concerned. It just doesn't matter. But one of the guys who is head of that party came to St. John and was advocating on his beliefs and his value system. And he was literally one person. He may have had one supporter with him. It was a very awkward scenario. And then there were probably 10 to 15 opposing him. I mean, let's be honest, across the barrier of four policemen. Policemen and women. And there was a screaming match going on. And I went down there because it was near where I live. And I thought to myself, this is literally a waste of time on both counts, because one side is never going to make sense to the other. And then the other side with the megaphone is never going to make sense to the other. But one thing that I thought was particularly insidious was actually from someone who's probably closer to my political ideology, starting a chant saying Nazi scum off our streets. Now, based on what the man was saying, that was a corruption of the term. This is not 1930s Germany. This is 2019 St. John. So there was a corruption of the term. It was really not, there's nothing even remotely like a dialogue. But then I thought to myself, look, there's two people on that side. There's 15 on this side. And the rest of the community is going about their day. So I think most people are open to having these discussions thoughtfully and open-mindedly. Maybe that's just me being an optimist. But I would bet that's the majority if you really dug down.
Yeah, that's interesting. And actually, we talk about privilege. I was at a wedding this past weekend, and the two people getting married were university professors, and many of the folks in attendance were, not many, but quite a few were university professors all in the U.S., one actually a professor at Harvard.
Cool.
Cool, yeah, for sure. And so we got into it on proportional representation, right? Because he's all like, oh, why, you know, Trudeau said he's changing the electoral system. He didn't change it. What's going to happen? And so we got into it on proportional representation. And his rationale, well, again, was like, you know, it works in all these other places, so it can work in Canada. But was that it allows for small parties and more diversity of parties to be elected. And that is interesting when, again, when we kind of talk about the fact that Canada is only 35 million people. And again, in a province like New Brunswick, 750,000 people. So what does diversity look like, right? And you know, in New Brunswick now, we have four parties in our legislature, and that's for 49 seats, 750,000, right? Mm-hmm. So do we have the capacity to even have more parties elected? But I think, you know, I think what has happened in the space of, I guess, dialogue maybe, or, you know, social justice dialogue, is for a long time we have alienated people that don't agree with us. And that, I think, makes it hard for people who are genuinely interested at engaging in a dialogue to understand. It makes it very difficult for them to take the first step. And you hear that a lot with, like, the feminist movement, right? You hear it a lot with people being like, well, I don't know what to say because I'm scared I'll offend you, or I'm scared I'll say something wrong and you're going to judge me. So I wonder how we remove those barriers, right? How we become more inclusive to that dialogue. Because I think you're right. I think generally people are curious and they want to have a conversation about things they don't necessarily know much about or want to learn mm-hmm. more about. So, yeah, how do we foster that dialogue in a way where people don't feel that they're going to be judged automatically?
I think you're right. There is a group of people, I think, that will remain silent because of that fear. Mm-hmm. And because you've seen even people sometimes that have made a comment in the form of a question, and they may have done it in a socially stupid way, but, for example, losing their job mm-hmm. or losing their livelihood. If we're stripping people of the right to earn a living for making a socially stupid question or making a socially silly comment, we probably risk the public dialogue going downhill pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people are just scared to engage, right? Mm. I think that's really interesting. I think a lot about that in regards to broadly the Me Too movement, because what you saw in Hollywood and with these, you know, big names, what we saw on social media is, you know, the first story runs in a media outlet and then 5 seconds later, this person has been let go from their job, completely mm-hmm. detached. Everyone's canceled them. They're not going to listen to their music. They're not going to watch their movies. They're just done with them, which is not actually what happens, right? It's through investigations and through steps and whether it's investigative journalism or actual, you know, police investigations, things like that, it comes to a head and that's when we see it, right? Mm. So the reason why, I'm not making excuses at all for people that perpetrate terrible things, but the reason why I am really nervous about what that looks like in the media is because we also know that it's something like 85% of sexual violence cases are perpetrated by somebody that the victim knows. And then we also know only about 5% of sexual violence cases are reported to the police. Mm-hmm. So if we say the victim, the survivor, knows the person who perpetrated violence against them, and then sees publicly that means, based on what I've seen publicly, this person is now going to lose everything. Well, I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not going to tell the police. I'm not going to do this because I don't genuinely want this person I know and maybe care about still and love or who is in my friend group. Like, I don't want to see them lose everything. So that's something that I've been thinking about a lot. Like, how do we hold people accountable?
Right.
But also create a restorative justice style program so that everyday people feel empowered to get justice.
Right.
And that, again, is the extreme side of what we're talking about, but I think it brings a bit of a light to what that looks like, right?
Yeah, I agree. Definitely getting justice for victims/survivors, but also, like you say, building something into the legal code or hopefully the social fabric where people can come back from the brink. Because who will our allies be if not the people who disagree with us that can change their mind?
Mm-hmm.
Because we cannot expose this bigotry of low expectations. People can change their mind.
Totally.
Donald Trump's can change their mind, as unlikely as it is. What if this man that I was talking to, who had converted, I think, 15 members of the Ku Klux Klan to see the error in their judgment or what had happened to them as young people that created these beliefs, what if he had never gone out and done that because mm-hmm. he thought it's not possible? Well, then we just have a bunch of people yelling at each other who are never going to agree.
Yeah.
So continuing this public dialogue is absolutely crucial. And I would love, Katie, to give the last word to you as we wrap this thing up. Talk to us about where people can find you, what you're thinking about, what you want people to go out into the world and do.
Yeah. Well, it actually ties into that really nicely. I think it's very easy for us to see things on social media or wherever and respond by, you know, a snarky tweet or something. What I'm trying to adopt in my life is when I see something that I have experience in and that I could provide value to the dialogue and I want to say something rude on social media, I'm going to send an email to the person or whatever. I'm going to say, hello, here is why I had a problem with this. Here are things I think you could do to ameliorate this. And how can we work together to create a solution rather than me tweeting at you on Twitter, right? So that's something I'm going to adopt into my personal kind of personal/professional life. And I'm already actively working to do that. We also, as I kind of briefly mentioned earlier, recently launched a t-shirt campaign. The t-shirts say a woman's place is in the house, and it has an outline of the House of Commons. Mm-hmm. This is our way of positively adding to the dialogue leading up to the 2019 federal election. We hope that folks will wear these shirts as kind of a badge of honor to say, you know, hey, I support electing more women. I think you should too. And hopefully create a bit of a conversation when, you know, they're stopped on the street or something to inquire about the t-shirt they're wearing. So those are the two big things that I'm kind of thinking about right now. Folks can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at FemWonk, and that's spelled FemmeWonk. Mm-hmm. And they can find the shirts at femwonk.com/buy, BUY, and podcast wherever you get your podcast. Yeah, that's where folks can find us. Yeah.
Cool.
What about you?
I think we did it. Yeah. My takeaway is that these public forums are absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. And that if the public dialogue breaks down, then our cultural agreements break down. And when our cultural agreements break down, you get a situation like the Democratic Republic of Congo or the Central African Republic, where there's just no social fabric intact, and it takes decades mm-hmm. to come back from the brink. I have a really close friend who grew up in the civil war in Somalia. And Somalia lost an entire generation of mm-hmm. people to this social breakdown. And my concern is that if we can't find a way to have public forums constructively, and I do not think, I'm sorry, Jack Dorsey, I don't think it's Twitter. I just don't. Twitter's great, but I just don't. I worry about the tech, but mostly I'm concerned with having public discussions, mm-hmm. having these, going down these rabbit holes that are seemingly difficult on a Tuesday afternoon, just for the sense of we need this mm-hmm. and we need each other. And so regardless of if you and I disagree on any of the small policy tweaks we might make, you are welcome here anytime. We're big fans. And it's been a lot of fun. Hopefully we've given each other a sense of what we're trying to do. And when we put this out on our platforms, people can tune in and take part.
Yeah, no, I look forward to continuing to create space for dialogues like this, whether it's with you or with others, and just, yeah, continuing to also promote Atlantic Canada and promote New Brunswick.
Yeah,
a bit.
Right?
So important. Yeah.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.